From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Bush administration has redrawn its longstanding plans for a possible attack on Iran, according to Seymour Hersh's article in the current edition of The New Yorker. Hersh says the Bush administration has also changed its justification for confronting Iran. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Seymour Hersh. Also, we hear from two people behind the new comedy-drama TV series Pushing Daisies, the creator Brian Fuller and director Barry Sonnenfeld. Fuller also wrote for the show Heroes, and Sonnenfeld directed the Men in Black and Addams Family films. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Ann Patchett's new novel Run, which he calls earnestly and daringly poignant. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Bush administration has ordered a new plan for a possible attack on Iran, and it's changed the justification for such an attack. This is what Seymour Hersh reports in his article Shifting Targets, the administration's plan for Iran, published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Hersh also writes that President Bush and members of his administration have redefined the war in Iraq as a strategic battle between the United States and Iran. Hersh has been writing in The New Yorker about a possible military strike against Iran since April of 2006. Seymour Hersh won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest in 2004 for his New Yorker pieces on intelligence and the Iraq War. He broke much of the Abu Ghraib story. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reports on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Seymour Hersh, welcome back to Fresh Air. You say that this summer, Vice President Cheney asked the Joint Chiefs of Staff to redraw the longstanding plans for a possible attack on Iran. What is the new plan?
The new plan, very simply, is technically it's called counter-terror versus counter-proliferation. In the old days, that is before this summer, all of the planning that was done for hitting Iran, as you know, there was extensive planning, it's been written about for years, was aimed at the nuclear entities of Iran as we knew them, the underground facilities, the facilities known to have been inspected, et cetera, they were all targeted, massive targeting. As somebody once said, 1,000 points of light, we were going to hit any nuclear-related area in the country, and that included not only in Tehran itself, but also three or four known places where they do enrichment, et cetera, and research. And the theory behind that hitting was, the public theory was, Iran's close to a nuclear bomb, and this is a threat that's not, that nobody in America would want, and this is an issue that, like in before the war in Iraq, the notion of a mushroom cloud, this is an issue that will really penetrate and resonate with the American people. Well, it didn't happen. The American people, according to what I've been told, the White House believes they've never really been able to sell the idea that Iran is an immediate nuclear threat. So what they've done in the last few months, and once I mention it, you'll know what I'm talking about, it's been a great deal of talk about the Iranians being responsible for our debacle in Iraq. It's Iranian being involved in providing the equipment for the little bombs, the IEDs that blow up American soldiers, providing arms, other kinds of support, not only for the Shia in the southern part of Iraq, you know, Iran is also Shia, but also for the Sunnis, and also at various times, the White House has even suggested the Iranians are supporting al-Qaeda, which is a very, you know, the Sunni terrorist group. So simply put, that argument is getting some traction with the American people, and also, more importantly, with some of our allies, particularly the Brits, the British. And so what they simply did is they've decided they're not going to hit everything big. They're going to keep an option for a surgical strike, hitting only the what they call the terrorist training camps across the border in Iran that are training the Sunni insurgency, so the White House claims, and hitting the Revolutionary Guards who have been painted in very harsh terms by this White House as sort of a terror force. And they've actually trying to legally describe them as a terrorist group, have the State Department declare them as such. So we're going to change the targeting.
You said part of the reason for invading Iraq was to change the Middle East, bring democracy there, watch that spread. And you're saying now the Bush administration is acknowledging that Iran, or at least some members of the Bush administration, are acknowledging that Iran has emerged as the geopolitical winner of the war in Iraq. How? And well, is that part of the reason, do you think, for these plans to attack Iran?
Look, the best guess is one of the things they've come to terms with, by the way, that's really important is they now accept the intelligence that says that the Iranians are pretty far away from a bomb. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA in Vienna, headed by Mr. El-Baradei, has been saying that. They've been saying, yes, they're making progress, but they're nowhere near as far along as you Americans think. And now it's clear, at least the White House accepts now, by the White House I mean Cheney, Bush et al., the core there, they accept that there's no bomb coming in the next 2 years, although it's still arguable that Iran still may be a threat. I'm not suggesting they're not interested in a bomb, but they're nowhere near it. So they accept that. And so why are they pushing this? Well, the issue has been all along, that's been a really strong issue all along, very early after the war began. In the June of 2003, the American intelligence community was trying to tell the White House that Iran is there big time. The position of the neoconservatives, et cetera, and the realists in the White House who advocated the war was that we're going to support the Shia, we're going to empower the Shia and diminish the power of the Sunnis. That's the game plan. And don't worry about the Shia and their longstanding relationship with Iran. After all, Iran and Iraq fought a war. The Shias in the South are going to be loyal to the state of Iraq. Well, from the very beginning, there were questions about the strong ties between the two that were dismissed out of hand by the White House. Well, now it turns out the Shias in the South want nothing to do with the Sunnis, are not very interested in the Kurds, and will very happily go off and be a nexus to Iran. Of course, Iraq's going to stay as an entity. And of course, there's going to be a lot of individualism. But there's just no question that the ties between the two, are Iran and Iraq, are the southern part of Iraq, where Basra is the headquarters of. The vast south is incredibly close to the Iranians.
What messages have you learned that the Bush administration has been sending to Iran behind the scenes?
That's a tough question because it constantly comes up. I constantly hear, and I was just having breakfast this morning with somebody, that there's a lot of contact between the two sides that we don't know. But the messages I really do hear explicitly are very tough. Bush really is very tough. He's sending messages. The message he gives the Iranians, shape up or, you know, we're going to kick your butt, basically. Shape up or we're coming after you. It's been very tough stuff. And, you know, we just had a negotiation with North Korea that was a successful negotiation on the nuclear issue there. And what did the Americans do? The United States position was very rational. We're going to talk to you about diplomatic recognition. We're going to talk to you about a security guarantee. We promise not to come and bomb you. And we give that to the North Koreans, and we got something for it. What do we offer the Iranians? 3 aircraft carriers in the Gulf. That's what we offer them. We don't talk to them. We don't make any positive suggestions to them. All we do is hector them. And the basic negotiating position we have on Iranians and, you know, nuclear enrichment, which has been going on for years that they're negotiating about, our position is you stop all enrichment, and then we'll have a conversation and talk to you about stopping it. That's our position.
What are your sources in the military and in the intelligence community telling you about a possible attack on Iran? And here's what I mean. Do your sources in the military think we have enough military to deal with it and with the aftermath of it? And do your intelligence sources tell you that we have enough intelligence to justify an attack?
Well, that's always a big issue. Right now, one of the things that the White House has done by proposing this new option, a surgical strike, and we should be clear that there's been no order to do a strike, and they could well do, you know, let's bomb everything to the smithereens and bring them back to the Stone Age. This is just an option. This option has a lot of traction, not only because it attracts some foreign leadership who are interested in it, it's more tolerable and more explicable. You can explain your bombing the Iranians who are only killing Americans and British and other coalition forces. Inside the military, it's interesting because this is called a third way by some military people. That is, it's a choice between doing nothing and hitting everything. This is a more rational. You hit those camps that we believe are sending stuff south. And yes, there is more support in the military for this. It would involve some special forces on the ground, which is always tricky. It would involve incredibly good intelligence. There's new leadership in the military that people don't pay much attention to. There's a new chairman, Admiral Mullen. Peter Pace, about whom I've written before, is someone who really objected a year ago to any possible nuclear adjunct to any planning and really offered, he and other officers said they would resign quietly, just retire early. He's gone now. And all of a sudden, you have a new member, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, about whom the public doesn't know much, as I said, Admiral Mullen, who is out of the Navy, and all of a sudden, the new proposal we have now includes a much bigger role for the Navy in any attack. This limited bombing would include Navy F-18s flying, along with Navy cruise missiles. And that puts the Navy back where they haven't been. They're not a big player in this war, and it puts them back on the table.
Have your sources in the military and the intelligence community expressed concerns about unintended consequences if we do this surgical strike on Iran?
I would say expressed concern is very mild. They share the same trepidation that many people outside the military share, which is this. The assumption is we're going to toggle some bombs. We're going to hit Iran with a limited hit The other side of it is we're going to ask our Western allies immediately, the Germans and the French, to immediately go to Iran and say, do not respond. Let's negotiate. Let's get to the table on this. That is the plan. That's one aspect of it. And the assumption is that the Iranians will withhold and not attack. And in fact, the word you hear from most of the experts is that as the Iranians are planning an attack, they are going to attack what they call, in the technical term, is asymmetrically. They're not necessarily going to respond to the United States or to Israel. They're going to attack other targets, oil targets. One of the things they are very interested in doing would be to drive up the price of oil well over $100, and a few attacks on some of the Gulf oil countries that are vast producers, that are all of their facilities are in the open, would cause enormous damage. You could also blockade the shipping lanes. There's a shipping lane to the Far East, and there's a shipping lane through the Straits of Hormuz that are very, very narrow. The Iranians could certainly put mines there and curtail the flow of oil. And like Saddam Hussein, who had months and years to prepare for an attack, and they do too. And I'll tell you right now, the insurgency we see in Iraq that we saw right away was not spontaneous. It was planned. It was planned by Saddam, meant much of it. And I think the same thing would happen here. We've given the Iranians really a year and a half or 2 years of intense threatening. We've been threatening them constantly. We've given them a great deal of time to think of innovative ways to strike back.
My guest is Seymour Hersh. His article, Shifting Targets, the Administration's Plan for Iran, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Seymour Hersh. In the current edition of The New Yorker, he reports that the Bush administration has ordered a new plan for a possible attack against Iran and has changed the justification for such an attack. I was reading about this new conservative group. I was reading about them in the New York Times. The group is called Freedom Watch. And apparently this month they're going to sponsor a private forum of experts on radical Islam. And they're expected to make the case that Iran poses a direct threat to the security of the United States. And the president of the group, Bradley Blakeman, said, "If Hitler's warnings were heeded when he wrote Mein Kampf, he could have been stopped. Ahmadinejad is giving all the same kind of warning signs to us and the region. He wants the destruction of the U.S. and the destruction of Israel." So that's the head of this new group, Freedom Watch. He's not saying, so target Iran, but it seems to be what he's saying between the lines, that Ahmadinejad needs to be stopped. So are there other groups that are on board?
Well, sure. In the article, I quote Norman Podhoretz, the editor-at-large of Commentary magazine, who's been writing very vigorously about it, and saying we must attack him, basically, and praising Bush as a man who will do it. So you have a neocon input, at least from Norman Podhoretz. Not all the neocons agree on this. American Jewish groups, by and large, not all of them. There's some committees that are very much against it, some of the law, but in general, a lot of American Jewish groups are very hostile to Iran and very useful to this administration in that sense. You see that impact in the politics, the Democratic politics. Hillary Clinton has said a lot of very tough things about Iran and the bomb. They must not be allowed to have it. Even Obama has. And you're seeing a suggestion. Obviously, it's not a secret that American Jewish money provides an awful lot of Democratic campaign funds, and that's a clear connection there. So there's a lot of pressure points outside of the White House that are advocating action against Iran. And again, the fact that the intelligence is much less clear than most people know, and the fact that the consequences from a bombing, I've had people tell me that one reason Cheney, who's I think shares the view that Iran must be stopped at any cost, one reason that Cheney is interested, I've been told this, I didn't write this in the story, is that he understands that once you start a bombing, why would Cheney support something less than he initially wanted, which is a large-scale bombing? Once you start bombing, it's very easy to escalate. The other side does something, you do something. The attack we have planned right now, the surgical strike, includes striking facilities, command and control facilities of the Revolutionary Guard inside Tehran, which means you're going to have to do very precise bombing. And I had a European official say to me, of course, we'll probably end up hitting a hospital or a school because bombs never go where they're aimed. That's one other issue, you know, that would harden the side of the Iranians and want them to do more. And then the other issue is we are going to send boys on the ground. Most of it will be done on air. We're going to spend special forces. Our special force units will go in. And the other thing you have to do is any air attack, even if it's a limited one by the Navy fighters, the Iranians have tremendous air defense batteries of missiles along the shore, along the Gulf, and they're dug in. And it's not clear you can take those out by air. And so you might have to send a Marine detachment, an expeditionary unit, 1,000 or so, maybe perhaps less, might have to send the Marines in on the ground to blow up some of these facilities before they can be used to bring down aircraft. And suppose some Marines get trapped on the ground in ground combat. And suppose they get taken hostage. What is the next step? And all of these things are driving a lot of my friends crazy, literally, on the inside. Because as usual, the White House only wants to see the picture it wants to see, which is we can go in and do this. And why are people talking to me? They're talking to me because they don't want this to happen.
If Iran does pose a threat, if Iran poses a threat in Iraq or poses a larger terrorist threat, do you think there are other ways of dealing with Iran?
In the talks, that there have been at least three meetings between our ambassador in Baghdad and the Iranians. There's been a series of meetings. In all of those meetings, the Iranians say the same message, I am told. I didn't write this. It just wasn't that relevant to the story. They say, one, they never say to the United States, get your troops out. What they say is, we can help you. We can help you in the south. There's no advantage in Iran to have the chaos they have in Iraq. Syria is another country. Syria right now has anywhere from 1.6 to 2 million refugees in its borders from Iran. And they've come across. Syria has a population of 17 million. It's led by a minority Alawite country. Here they have 2 million Sunnis, mostly Sunnis and some Christians, living there now with no source of income, et cetera, et cetera. I hear horrific stories about the troubles they're having just staying alive. And it's very hard on Syria. Why wouldn't Syria want to do what it could to join in an international peacekeeping operation with the Iranians, with whom Syria has a longstanding relationship, particularly now in terms of antipathy to the United States? Why wouldn't they want to join in with the other countries? Jordan right now has 800,000 refugees. There are refugees all over. It's like another Palestinian crisis. Why wouldn't they want an international conference to do something to put pressure on the parties inside to resolve their crisis? This is so much more of an efficient way to do it. We're not going to be able to do it by force. And frankly, I'll tell you, I now believe that the 200-octane fuel that keeps the insurgency going to a large degree is us. It's harder to make this clear now. 2 years ago, before the sectarian violence, Sunni-Shia violence was so great, I could argue easily the faster we get out, the more quickly the various factions will get together. There's a lot of oil there that everybody can share. There's tons of money there and potentially in the underground reservoirs. You've got, you know, billions, if not, or hundreds of millions of untapped oil. But that's not happening. Can anybody say to me that in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, it's going to get better with us there? And so what I say, I have said it, I have to maybe rethink it now as things get so bad, but I've been saying there's basically only two options to end the war. One, option A, get everybody out by midnight tonight. And option B, get us out by midnight tomorrow. And forget about bringing in the UN peacekeepers. Anybody that comes in, whether they're Muslim or not, is going to be an occupier. They've had it with occupiers. Let them get together and see if in the tribal system, which still is very strong, they can work out some agreement. If we did that, I assure you, the Iranians and the Syrians and the Jordanians and the Kuwaitis would do all they could to try and stabilize the situation, write off debt, lend money. Nobody needs an Iraq that's exploding.
Do you have any sense of what the odds are that the Bush administration would decide to attack Iran?
It's very clear I don't know. The president has not signed an execute order, which he has to do. It's much easier for him now to do this kind of bombing because you don't have, if you're going to do limited bombing without major Air Force participation, the Air Force is some great big combine. They have to move pilots and the big bombers and all the equipment to various staging bases, and it takes weeks and months, and the buildup would be seen by all. The plan now is very quick. The Navy is right now flying combat missions every day into Iraq. They can simply do a sharp turn and go over Iran. Cruise missiles can be reprogrammed. They already have been. And so it's much easier to do it. And the answer is, I'd be crazy to say I know. I choose to write this story. I have a panoply of things that I can write about. You know, there's so many other issues now with this war. But I choose to focus on this because I think whatever the odds are, the consequences of an attack on Iran are so horrific in terms of bringing us into Brzezinski was saying to me, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former Carter's former national security advisor, we're looking, if we hit Iran, we're looking at a 20-year war. The Iranians will do something. Iran has two border countries that are pretty much in which America has a great deal of influence, Iraq and Afghanistan. They will do something in both those countries. Anything they do in Afghanistan will bring in Pakistan into it. I mean, you're looking at just a wildfire of stuff. And if you get Hezbollah going, if you toggle Hezbollah, that one-time great terrorist group from off, which it is now, to on, you could have some really serious stuff going on. You know, not only attacks on in the Middle East, but around the world. I can't understand why a president wouldn't do anything, including summit meetings in Tehran or some neutral ground, to avoid this. But there's no evidence he's going to talk to those people.
Well, Seymour Hersh, thank you so much for coming on our show. Thank you.
Always fun, Terry.
Seymour Hersh's article on Iran is in the current edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new TV series Pushing Daisies is a comedy drama fantasy about a young man who could bring the dead to life and then back to death by a mere touch. Coming up, we meet the show's creator, Brian Fuller, and its director, Barry Sonnenfeld. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Ann Patchett's new novel, Run. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pushing Daisies, the most positively reviewed new series of the fall TV season, premieres tomorrow night on ABC. Our guests are Brian Fuller, the creator of the show, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of the pilot episode. Sonnenfeld also directed the Addams Family and Men in Black films, as well as Get Shorty. He started his career as a cinematographer and shot several films for the Coen brothers, including Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing. Fuller broke into TV by writing for two shows in the Star Trek franchise. Then he created the cult TV series Wonder Falls and Dead Like Me, and last season wrote and produced for Heroes. Pushing Daisies revolves around a young man, Ned, who has the unusual and unexplained gift of bringing dead people back to life with a single touch. Here's a scene from tomorrow's pilot. Ned works with a private detective on unsolved murders. Their current case is the murder of Ned's childhood sweetheart, Chuck. In a funeral home, Ned awakens Chuck from the dead. But unless he touches her again within a minute and takes her life away for good, someone else will die.
Chuck, wait!
Who are you?
Do you remember the little boy who lived next door to you when your dad died?
Ned? Oh my God, hey, how are you?
Good, you look great. Do you know what's happening right now?
I had the strangest dream. I was being strangled to death with a plastic sack.
You were strangled to death with a plastic sack. That's probably an odd thing to hear, but I wasn't quite sure how to sugarcoat it.
Oh.
You only have a minute, less.
What can I do in less than a minute?
You can tell me who killed you, so, you know, justice can be served.
Well, that's really sweet, but I don't know who killed me. I went to go get ice, and I dropped my room key in the ice maker. And as I was thinking, that was dumb.
As she was thinking that was dumb, Chuck was strangled to death with a plastic sack.
And then you touched my cheek.
What's going on?
Just a second.
Is my time up?
I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for calling me Chuck. Do you know no one's called me Chuck since you?
I used to. When I lived next door to you, I had a you were my first kiss.
Yeah? You were my first kiss, too. You wanna be my last kiss? First and last? Or is that weird?
That's not weird. It's symmetrical.
Our TV critic and occasional guest host, David Bianculli, spoke with Barry Sonnenfeld and Brian Fuller. He asked Fuller to describe the premise of Pushing Daisies.
The story is about a young man named Ned who is a pie maker, and he discovers as a child that he has a gift that he can touch dead things and bring them back to life. But this gift has a caveat or two, and those caveats are if he touches the dead once, they come back to life. If he touches them again, they go back to being dead and dead again forever, never to be revived. And the third caveat is if he lets a dead person live for longer than a minute, then someone else has to die. And he decides in our pilot that his childhood sweetheart, when she dies, she deserves to be brought back for good, and makes a decision to let somebody die to get his lost love back.
Now, every time I describe this to people, after telling them that I think it's my favorite new show of the fall, they look at me like I'm slightly deranged. But once you get past that initial description, can you talk about why it is that you're able to hit grace notes that make this more intelligent and witty and less just sci-fi strange than it sounds?
I think it just goes to the characters and the character relationships. So we're all wanting to be in relationships, and we all want someone to love in our lives, and all those relationships are going to come with complications. And if the basic complication is that you can't touch each other, then it forces you to get to know somebody and be intimate in a way where you don't have the hurdle of physicality to get over, because it's never an option.
Part of what's so charming about the pilot is the visual look which Barry, you bring to it as the director, or are greatly involved in bringing it as the director. How do you collaborate together and with the costume designer and with the lighting designer and with the actors even to make sure that everybody's on a uniform tone for something that's kind of like a fable?
Well, for me, and this is Barry talking, the definition of a director is a sort of the tone police, and a director has to decide what the tone of a show is going to be, and then make sure everything is consistent to that tone, whether it be the lighting, the camera angles, the nature of the way actors talk, the pace in which they talk, the way the camera covers the way those people talk, the costumes they wear. And again, based on Brian's script, the tone to me was quite obvious, although I will say that the tone is a very narrow bridge to walk on in this show, that it could have gotten too jokey or too sad or too silly. So Brian's script sort of defined the tone. It was my job with Brian to maintain that tone in everything from visual effects to camera angles to lighting. But that's to me, that's the job of a director.
And why the focus on so many stage actors? This is by no means a complaint, but you have Kristen Chenoweth, Swoozie Kurtz, Ellen Green, some really remarkable talent there in supporting roles.
It really wasn't any sort of intentional agenda to get a lot of stage actors. I think it was the training of stage performers is more conducive to the tone of the show. And you know, I used to work on Star Trek for many years, and we often found that since Star Trek was a heightened reality, that we would cast a lot of stage actors because they found a way to make that heightened reality emotionally real. And so with Kristen and Swoozie and Ellen and Anna and Lee, who all have a lot of stage training, they made the heightened reality real.
Barry, let me ask you a question about the Coen brothers. You started as a cinematographer on Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, which is one of my absolute favorites. And I'm wondering, did you develop and absorb their style, or did they develop and absorb yours?
Joel and Ethan Coen and I worked on our first three movies together. In fact, the first time I had ever been on a movie set in my life, or the Coen brothers in their lives, was the first day on the set shooting Blood Simple. None of us worked our way up. We just sort of got lucky and raised some money and made the movie. And I had done a lot of still photography work before that and loved the wide-angle lens. I thought it had a real energy to it. And so we developed a look together, and, you know, I learned a lot from them and they learned a lot from me, but it was really incredibly collaborative, very much the way it is now with Brian and myself on Pushing Daisies.
One thing that you do in your films as director that seems to carry on to the television program is to trust your actors a great deal, to have some scenes go in wide frame where we get to see what two or three of them are doing at a time, and to trust them to act. Is that an accurate assessment, and is that something that you're doing intentionally?
That's an incredibly astute question, and I'm going to take a minute to answer that. First of all, I think great comedy plays in two shot because you have action and reaction in the same shot. If you look at all the screwball comedies by Preston Sturges or Howard Hawks, you've got Cary Grant in a bathrobe, and you've got Katharine Hepburn calling him Mr. Bones, which isn't his name, and bringing up Baby. And the only reason, or part of the reason that works, is because it plays out in a two-shot. You have Cary Grant reacting while Katharine Hepburn is being hysterical in the same shot. It requires really good writing, first of all, so that you don't need to cover the scene in order to edit out the bad words or the stuff that you cringe when you read it going to work that morning. And then, in addition, the director has to pace the actors to give you the comic pacing in that shot, so you don't have to try to pace up the scene later by covering the close-ups. But I find a lot of comedies are shot in a really lazy style with a lot of close-ups, and I never want to cut to the punchline of a joke. I want the audience to think they're smarter than me, so that they see where the joke is, and it's as if they don't even know that I knew where the joke was. I like them to discover where the joke is.
My guests are Brian Fuller, the creator of Pushing Daisies, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director. They're both executive producers. What were the first movies or TV shows you saw that really sparked your imagination?
I would say one of the biggest influences on my writing and imagination was The Twilight Zone. It's, you know, very often they were one-act plays that had characters that were reacting very realistically to incredibly absurd situations, and they always kind of had an emotional realism to them, but we were allowed to see this fantastic world that wasn't contained within the parameters of reality.
Well, Barry, same question to you.
I came very late to movies because I had this painfully shy childhood. I wasn't a movie goer. I was profoundly thin, couldn't get a date, and didn't want to go to movies by myself. And B, the only thing you would see at movies was people falling in love and having dates and getting married. So, and I knew that wasn't going to happen to me either. So I came very, very late to movies. And the movie that to this day is my favorite movie that was one of the first movies I saw was Dr. Strangelove.
No, oh,
which
wow.
is you know, as black a comedy, you never want to tell anyone you're making a black comedy because the studios never want to make black comedies. I remember trying to get a movie made at Paramount after Addams Family did over $100 million, and the head of the studio was saying, "Well, you know, we don't make black comedies here." And I said, "Well, kind of Addams Family." So, but I'm a big black comedy fan, and Strangelove is my favorite movie.
Well, that's really interesting because Kubrick films most of the scenes in Strangelove in exactly the way that you've described, as you preferring to set up your comedy scenes.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the things that makes Strangelove so great is to see Sterling Hayden and Peter Sellers in the same frame, looking in the same direction with Jack D. Ripper explaining why, you can't drink water and milk and, you know, the whole purity of essence mm-hmm. thing. So that movie is often played in the Comedy 2 shot, and what makes it hysterical is seeing action and reaction in that same shot. So when I mentioned Howard Hawks and Preston Sturges, I should have also mentioned Kubrick as he directed Strangelove.
We're listening to our TV critic David Bianculli interviewing the creator of the new TV series Pushing Daisies, Brian Fuller, and the director of the show's pilot, Barry Sonnenfeld. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our TV critic David Bianculli interviewing Brian Fuller, the creator of the new TV series Pushing Daisies, and film director Barry Sonnenfeld, who also directed the pilot of Pushing Daisies.
Your jobs, your first jobs in what we could call show business.
I know where this is going, Dave.
You don't even know.
That's so cheap.
Listen, Dave. You don't even know to whom this question is directed yet, because both of you guys broke in, if my information is correct, in fairly unorthodox and very different fashions. And I was just going to ask, who wants to go first?
I want Brian to go first.
I started in porn. And that's actually a segue into Barry's story, yeah. So I'll let him go. That was very passive aggressive of me.
And I wasn't going to mention it. When I got out of film school, I thought I had some talent as a cinematographer, so I thought if I owned a camera, I could call myself a cameraman without being sort of effete about it. So I bought a used 16mm camera, and the first job I got was shooting 9 feature-length pornos in 9 days. The 9 days were so sexually disgusting, perverse, and, you know, my theory is if porns included the sense of smell, no one would ever go see a porn again.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So Blood Simple would be the first thing on your resume.
Actually, Blood Simple would be the second thing. I shot a documentary called In Our Water.
That was nominated for an Academy Award.
No. I love documentaries, and in fact, it helped me discover a certain style of shooting involving sort of wide-angle lenses, and it's a different way of shooting documentaries. But Blood Simple was the first time I was a cinematographer on a feature film for the Coen brothers.
But didn't you get
in Austin, Texas?
Didn't you get Blood Simple because of your work on the documentary, though?
Oh no! I got the job on Blood Simple because Joel Coen and myself were the only two Jews at a party filled with wasps on the Upper East Side one night, and we sort of smelled each other from across the room and came together. we discovered that we had both gone to NYU film school, although we didn't know each other then. And he was telling me that he had just written a script for Blood Simple, and he was going to shoot a trailer as if it was a finished film and use that as a technique to raise money. And I said, hey, I own a camera. And he hired me that night, and we went off and shot the trailer of that would have become the trailer for Blood Simple. And a year later, we were on a movie set. But no, it was merely because I owned a camera that Joel Cohen found me that night and hired me.
Wow. Which scenes were used in the trailer?
Well, because we didn't have any actors yet, you know, because we hadn't raised the money, it was shot in a very sort of stylized way. So we shot the yellow lines of a road. And you know the scene near the end of Blood Simple where M. Emmett Walsh shoots holes through the bathroom?
Oh, yes, sure.
Wall, and you see those beams of light. So we recreated that, but we didn't have what are called squibs or any explosives. So we cut big round holes in a wall and then patched them up again. And then while I dollied in on the wall, a guy in the back, Don Wigman, behind the wall, was hitting the holes with a hammer. And that's how we created. You know, the plugs went out so fast, you didn't see them in the darkness. So, you know, the funny thing is, we then shot Blood Simple and had a real professional guy with squibs and explosives, and we set the holes according to a specific pattern, and it didn't look nearly as good as it did with, as compared to Don Wigman with a hammer in the back of the wall.
And Brian, if you still remember the question,
Dave.
Yes, I'd like you to answer it in terms of no. I'm just saying the way that you broke into the business was very unusual. It may have smelled better, but.
it was much more olfactory friendly. I submitted a spec script to Star Trek Deep Space Nine and got invited in to pitch. So there was a time when Star Trek had an open script submission policy, at which they which went away shortly afterwards because of the lawsuits. But I managed to get in under the gun with folks like Ronald Moore, who you know reimagined Battlestar Galactica for mm-hmm. the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was a great way to get into writing. And I saw the show, I liked the show a lot, and I decided to write a spec script, and I did, and it got me in the door, and I sold a couple of stories, and then they gave me a script, and I was on staff for 4 years.
Can you define what a spec script is?
A spec script is something that you write that you're not getting paid for, and oftentimes writers will use them as a resume. It's a sample of your work that shows that you can actually write a script, and there's two ways to do it. You can either write an original spec script, which is basically a pilot that hasn't been ordered, but a pilot that you would like to see and like to write. And the other one is to look at a show, an existing show like Desperate Housewives or Ugly Betty, and write an episode that you come up with and give it to people. So it's a writing sample.
And what did you learn most in terms of doing television, and specifically fanciful television?
I got into writing to become a Star Trek writer. I was a rabid fan. I had shelves and shelves and shelves of action figures in my bedroom that scared away more dates than I care to admit to. And so it was really, if back then you told me you're going to write for Star Trek for 20 years, I couldn't have imagined a happier career. But after writing for Star Trek for 4 years and bumping up against the parameters of the storytelling, which sometimes were very restrictive because there was always that magical reset button and you could never carry story arcs over the episodes because they were so heavily syndicated that it just simply wasn't allowed. I began to get itchy and wanting to tell stories with a little more emotional depth, because one of the things about the Star Trek universe, especially the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, were that the characters were so much more evolved than we were that they wouldn't be terrified when they're looking at a giant Borg cube about to assimilate them. They would handle their jobs and they would behave responsibly and calmly. And I just had a hard time relating to that after a certain point. And then my last year on Voyager, I wrote Dead Like Me on spec.
Brian Fuller, Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
Brian Fuller created the new TV series Pushing Daisies, which premieres tomorrow night on ABC. Barry Sonnenfeld directed the pilot. They spoke with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Coming up, a review of Ann Patchett's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Ann Patchett's best-selling novel Bel Canto improbably blended the worlds of guerrilla warfare and opera in a romantic narrative that compelled critics and readers alike to give her a standing ovation. Patchett's new novel is called Run, and book critic Maureen Carrigan is leaping to her feet once more.
It's been a long time since I've teared up at the end of a novel. I think I'd have to go back to my first ever reading of Stuart Little about 7 years ago to find the last trace of tears before this week when I finished Ann Patchett's new novel, Run. Run touched me deeply, and in this Pomo age where irony is still equated with intelligence in writing and criticism, it's no small thing to come upon a work of serious literary fiction that's earnestly and daringly poignant. But I was also moved to tears for another reason. It's the easy virtuosity of Patchett's technique that's also affecting. She's just so good at everything here. The subtlety of the characters, the atmosphere of a fully realized world, the overall intricate plot design that gives a reader reassurance that an all-powerful author god is sitting comfortably in the pilot seat. Like her previous wonder of a novel, Bel Canto, Run limits itself to a contained setting and a tight little group of characters. In Bel Canto, her characters were hostages to a rebel band of guerrillas. In Run, they're hostages to the weather. When Run opens, a nighttime snowstorm is falling over Boston, one of those snows that blankets and silences a city. Bernard Doyle, a former mayor of Boston, is leaving a Jesse Jackson lecture with two of his college-aged sons, Tip and Teddy. It's necessary to note, because the plot turns on this fact, that despite their Boston Irish monikers and their Celtic custom of calling their father Da, Tip and Teddy are African American. They were adopted as babies by the pale-faced Doyle and his late wife, who died many years ago of cancer. After the lecture, Tip stubbornly announces he's returning to his lab in the basement of the Natural History Museum at Harvard, where he studies his great passion, fish. Doyle tries to stop him, and in the middle of the blinding blizzard, as father and son are arguing, an SUV comes out of nowhere. It probably would have hit and killed Tip, but a woman, a black woman named Tennessee, spots the SUV bearing down and leaves her 11-year-old daughter on the snowy pavement and runs to push Tip to safety, in the process getting hit herself. So ends just the first chapter of this novel that will track the Doyles and their savior through this surreal night and the day that follows, when snow is general over Boston. That allusion to Joyce's masterpiece, The Dead, is deliberate, because Patchett plays with the eeriness of a nighttime snowstorm. She dramatizes the same sense that Joyce had, that the boundary between past and present, the living and the dead, is more permeable as snow falls out of a dark sky and shrouds everything below. Tennessee is brought to the hospital and hovers there in a limbo state. Ghosts walk, long-buried memories and emotional bonds and secrets of identity emerge all throughout these strained hours. Patchett makes coincidences that might seem too far out even for Dickens seem plausible through the glowing vitality of her language. Here, for instance, is a passage given to us by an omniscient narrator where Tip and Teddy's uncle, a dying priest named Father Sullivan, ruminates on the likelihood of an afterlife, which he started to doubt. Look at all these true believers who wanted only to live. Look at himself, clinging onto this life like a squirrel scrambling up the icy pitch of a roof. How wrong-headed it seemed now to think that the thrill of heartbeat and breath were just a stepping stone to something greater. What could be greater than the armchair, the window, the snow? Why wouldn't it stand to reason that this had been the whole of existence, and now he would retreat back to the nothingness he had come from in order to let someone else have their turn at the view? We readers are assured that Father Sullivan's 11th-hour doubts are not the workings of disbelief, but rather a joyful realization of all he had been given. And indeed, that's the miracle that's worked throughout this novel. Run takes devastating moments of loss and regret and scatters them into a sweeping Milky Way arc of dazzling affirmation, without itself somehow becoming cosmically cheap and sentimental as a work of fiction. Maybe you won't actually tear up, as I did, if you read Run, but I guarantee that even the most cynical of readers won't roll their eyes either.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Ann Patchett's new novel, Run. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, with a revised website at pewtrusts.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tasteless doesn't even begin to describe the humor of Sarah Silverman when she deals with AIDS, abortion, and sexual predators. But the thing is, what seems tasteless on the surface is usually very perceptive satire. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with her about the Sarah Silverman program, which has started its new season on Comedy Central. Join us for the next Fresh Air.